was your first experience with mathematics?
Well, I've been doing mathematics ever since I was a small child. That's my life story. It's not every mathematician's life story, but I was one of those who started very young. So I'm not sure I can point to a first moment. A story I tell in the book, though, which I think of as kind of a formative moment, is this time that I'm kind of, and at this point, I must be like, maybe I'm 6 years old or something like this, looking at a rectangular array of holes in the speaker cabinet in my house, listening to some music. It's a 6x8 array of holes. Just having this moment, and I think at this age, because I had been doing math a lot, I sort of knew multiplication tables, right? I knew what 6 times 8 was 48. Looking at these 6 rows of 8 holes each, and then kind of, you know, letting your eyes focus in and out and flip in and out, and seeing 8 columns of 6 holes each, and like suddenly grasping that the reason that 6 times 8 and 8 times 6 were the same number, I mean, this was a fact I knew because I knew the multiplication table, but this moment of realizing that it's not just that it was that way, it's that it had to be that way, because there were 48 holes in the speaker cabinet. How many holes there were how many holes there were, whether you counted it as 6 groups of 8 or 8 groups of 6, that, at least in my memory, was a kind of cataclysmic cognitive event to understand that that was not just a sequence of facts, but was organized in some a priori way, and it could be no other way. Mm-hmm. So that's my conversion story. That's my, like, Paul on the road to Damascus.
Now, where did you grow up?
Not too far from here, actually, in Potomac, Maryland, in Montgomery County.
So were you in a family environment that encouraged the mathematics that you were interested in?
Well, I was in a family environment that was very rich in mathematics. I mean, my parents are both statisticians. At the time when I was born, my mom did not have her PhD yet. She was teaching math in high school. And she went back and got her PhD in statistics here at GW when I was a small child. So there was lots of math around.
Now, given that math being around, what was it like then being in school, certainly in the earlier grades, coming in with a lot of mathematical knowledge already?
For me, it was great. People have a lot of different stories. I know plenty of people who have said that they found it, who were ahead in math, who were ahead of their grade in math, and they said they found it difficult or alienating. I never found it that way. I think other kids knew that I was advanced in math later. Not when I was a very small child, but like later in elementary school, I would, like, you know, go to a junior high school and like take math from there. So it was clear I was like getting up and like leaving the school. But I think other kids saw it the way they would think of any other like cool things you could do. Like if you could like jump really high or roll your tongue or like do some other tricks. So I mean, kids would, I remember it's like kids would like go like, oh, like what's 1,000,000 times 1,000,000? And then I would like say what it was and they'd be like, awesome. Like it was, I mean, people were pretty into it. So I think I was very lucky in that way. Mm-hmm. I never felt like, oh, I need to get out of this non-mathematical environment. I was quite happy in school.
So how inevitable was it that you would go on in math, that you would become a mathematician, that you would end up in academia?
I don't think it's inevitable at all. I think it's interesting to think about, certainly when I was kind of finishing college and thinking about careers, it wasn't like it is now where I think there's this giant pull from Silicon Valley where there are like really intellectually interesting jobs that people who are highly skilled in math can go and do that are outside academia. I mean, of course there were, but it was not at the same level. It wasn't kind of a lodestar of our culture the way it is now. But I don't think it was inevitable, and I was interested in a lot of stuff, and I really tried different things. After college, I went and did a degree in creative writing for a year. I thought I might, like, I think I probably knew I wasn't really going to try to do that for a living, but I was serious enough about it to, like, try for a year, and that experience was actually extremely useful to me because it was kind of a bummer not to be doing math. Like, every day I was like, this is fun, but I miss doing math. why aren't I doing math? That was actually a very useful experience to have, because, you know, grad school is like very hard, and there are days when you're like, oh my God, why am I doing this? And then it's nice to actually have that experimental proof that, as difficult as it is to struggle with math, it's like even more difficult to not be struggling with math and be away from it, at least for me.
Now, going back just a little bit then, how did you get involved with math competitions?
Well, part of it was that, again, I was very lucky to have a guy, Eric Wallstein, who like came and taught me a lot. So basically I learned the K-12 math curriculum like from him. He would come to my house, so we would talk about math and basically go through the courses. So we worked through basically everything up through calculus at an accelerated rate. And after that, you know, when I was, I guess probably when I was in like 8th grade or whatever, I would go over to the University of Maryland and take classes. I would ride the good old J2 bus out to Silver Spring and then take the shuttle to College Park. Now I think the subway goes there. It would have been great if they had that then. But the point is that Eric Wallstein, in addition to being a guy who went around the county like meeting with like very accelerated young kids in math, also was in charge of the Montgomery County math team. Mm-hmm. So through him, I really was, you know, hooked into the competition scene very early. And that was really fun. I mean, it meant that, again, I think some kids express this feeling of like, oh, I'm in this school and there's like nobody here to talk to about math, and that meant they feel alienated. Because of math team, I had that community of older kids who were where I was mathematically, mm-hmm. and it wasn't in my school. Like, I didn't need to get that like from my school because I had it, like, you know, in this mm-hmm. after school, like night, like math team context. I mean, it's a big deal in Montgomery County, and still is. I mean, we sent, I think we used to send, and maybe still do, like 4 full teams of 15 kids each to Armel every year, and a separate kind of junior high school team. So, I mean, 75 kids who were like meeting every week, and like, it was a very rich scene.
So there were a variety of competitions you could also enter, not just the ones that the MA runs, the AMC series, USAMO, and so.
That's right. So there was those were sort of the Armel track, right, which is the kind of different counties going head to head. But then there was what we used to call the MAA. That was just
right.
We called it. Now it's not even called OSMI anymore, right? It was called MAA and then OSMI, and now I think it's called AMC 12. Is that right?
Yes.
And now it's multiplied into like all these cool divisions,
right.
Like the under 21 soccer league, right? There's
right.
like AMC 12, 10, and 8.
Right.
I put an AMC 8 question on my midterm exam, my discrete math course, by the way. I didn't tell them it was a problem for anything. But it was one of the easier, I mean, most everyone got it, actually. It was one of the easier questions.
Right.
But if, I was considering if people didn't get it, should I say, like, by the way, that was on an 8th grade math class. Actually, I don't remember like when I started doing those. I certainly did those exams like when I was in high school, but I don't remember if I did those when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved them. I mean, I sort of loved. I had like those books, which I think are also from the MAA, like books of old problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were in like the Dolciani series, is that right? I have an image, they were like white paperbacks.
Yes.
With like a sans serif font on the cover.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. They still exist.
I spent a lot of time with them.
You made it to USAMO
mm-hmm.
once or more than that?
I think, I mean, this can be looked up. I don't actually,
yeah.
Actually somebody told me I think Richard Rustick told me a funny story, which I do not remember, but this is what he told me, so I guess it's true. He said that, so I won the USAMO one time, I think when I was a senior,
right.
And Richard told me that I had to give like a little speech, and so I stood up and I said, like, according to him, I said, oh, I'd like to thank Ravi Fakil for finally graduating so that somebody else could win the USAMO. That was my, because I think he would win every year, and all the Americans would be like, it's the USAMO, why are we letting this Canadian guy win every time? So,
right.
But it's nice, you know, the other nice thing about the competitions is there is this community of people, not just from your own town, but you sort of, I mean, I knew Ravi from, you know, I still know him and talk to him a lot today about math and
yes.
education and, like, algebraic geometry and all kinds of, and all kinds of things.
So where was IMO that year?
IMO, so I went to IMO 3 times.
Oh, 3 times, okay.
That I remember, so, I went in Havana, and in Australia, and in West Germany.
Right.
Those were the three that I went to. So I was gonna say, like, it's funny. I think I'm giving a pretty sunny view of my relationship with competitions.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went through a period. I think if you would ask me when I was like a grad student or, you know, anytime in my 20s, I might have said like, I think I had a sort of more negative view of competitions.
Mm-hmm.
I think I felt like, because it was when I was, you know, when you go to college and especially when you go to grad school, you realize just how different the actual practice of mathematics is from competitions. You realize just how much the discipline of mathematics is a communal thing and fundamentally not a competitive thing, or at least not a competitive thing in the same way that math contests are. Not that there's no competition at all, but it's something that I really love about our profession, that don't you feel like you know, physicists and biologists are like mad at each other like way more than we are? Like they're much more like, I'm gonna get it so those guys are not. I feel like in math, the ethos of our culture is much more like, of course it feels good to get something, and it feels good to be like, oh, other people tried to do this and couldn't do it, and I did it. But in the end, you feel like we're all like pushing on the same rock.
Mm-hmm.
We're all pushing in the same direction. I think that's somehow fundamental to the way we do things. But, so I think I went through a period of being like, oh, competitions, they're stupid. They like hide from people what math is really about.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really feel that way anymore. I mean, I think back and really think about all the value I got from having that community of people that was organized around competitions. Like, yes, the goal of a competition is kind of simplistic. Like, you try to do a problem in, like, 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 3.5 hours in the case of the IMO. It's not, like, real math. But it builds community. It's a way in for a lot of people. I think things like AMC, which are so widely spread, you know, if we think about how are we going to get math talent from schools that are not in the kind of Boston to DC metroplex or the Silicon Valley metroplex, right? I mean, this is one means by which we can do that. Like, send, I mean, good Lord, like, how many tens of thousands of these exams do you guys send out? I mean, it's a huge number. I looked at the statistics.
Right.
And I had no idea how big. It's much bigger than when I was a kid, right?
Yes.
So how many AMC 12s do you guys send out? Do you know? Isn't it, like, in the hundreds of thousands?
Oh, yes. It's about 190,000, 180,000, something of that.
Right, so this is, like, a big, it's a big net.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not that many other ways in which, am I right about this, in which we're casting this kind of net.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it does good. And it's like, we were talking before the interview started about broadcasting on all channels and, like, different kinds of things, capturing the attention and engaging, like, different students and people being so different. So I feel like, even though there are differences between competition math and real math, I can't deny that my attention was captured by these competitions, and it did, like, help bring me into the community, and I think that's been true for a lot of other people, too. So,
so out of this, all of your full background here, how did you end up going to Harvard?
You know, Harvard is Harvard, so I think, certainly when I was a kid, I think that was, like, where the Olympiad people largely went. It was, like, where people felt that there was the most action going on in undergraduate math. So, and my parents went there.
Mm-hmm.
So all the, everything was pushing in the same direction. And I loved it there, actually. I mean, I still do love it there.
Right. And you were there for full undergraduate, right through your graduate degree?
Right. Well, I mean, with a year away to do the creative writing degree.
Yes.
But I was, but yeah, they sort of go through periods. Sometimes they, like, take their own undergraduates and as PhDs, and then they sort of, they're like, no way, we shouldn't do this, and they don't do it for a while, and then they forget why they don't do it, and then they start doing it again, and then so it sort of goes in cycles. When I was there, there was a lot of Harvard undergrads there in the grad program.
So as you were going through Harvard, how did you start thinking what your specialty in math would be?
Well, that came later, and there's a lot of ways to do college when you're studying math, and I took very seriously the kind of liberal arts ethos of Harvard, and I think I took one more than the minimum number of math courses you could take and graduate with a math major, because I wanted to do a lot of other stuff, and I did that. So I think there's an approach of doing maximal acceleration and trying to get as quickly as you can to the graduate courses, and lots and lots and lots of Harvard undergrad math majors, I know because I read graduate application files, start taking graduate courses in their sophomore year and basically never look back. And that's definitely a way to do it that works for a lot of people. It wasn't what I wanted to do. So this is a long-winded way of saying that I really didn't know, there was no way I could have known anything as sophisticated as what I wanted my mathematical specialty to be, because I just, you know, quite frankly, didn't know that much math when I graduated. I mean, so I think that developed, you know, I wrote a senior thesis, which was an amazing experience, with Percy Diaconis in combinatorial group theory. He was very interested in, at the time, and well, still is, in random walks on groups. And I loved that subject. It was very, you know, sort of, in some sense, combinatorics is like very big in contest math, so I like already had this sort of pre-existing interest in it. And I really enjoyed writing that thesis, but when I came to grad school, it was, I guess, the fall of 94 when I started. So it was in that kind of post-Wiles moment when, like, everybody who didn't know what they wanted to do and just had broad interest in math, like, we all became number theorists, right? Everybody was like, I'm going to learn about modular forms, I'm going to learn about Galois representations, like, holy crap, we can't believe what just happened. So, so I was part of that rush. Like, I feel like all the first year grad students were like, well, this is what's happening, like.
You said you did your thesis with Percy Diaconis.
Mm-hmm. My undergraduate thesis.
Your undergraduate thesis.
Yeah.
He was at Harvard at that time. He's
That's right.
At Stanford now.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have an influence just from his own interests and so on in what you did, or look that further beyond there?
I think.
He's not.
Wait,
quite
let me ask you to unpack that question.
He's not quite your usual faculty member, it seems.
No, although I think that's maybe not. When you're a college student, like, I think that's not so visible. Just, like,
mm-hmm.
professors are these, like, exalted beings, and they all...
Yes.
I mean, I think, for instance, I remember sort of saying something to Dick Gross, like, I think I, like, asked him if, like, he and Mazur were in grad school together or something, and he was like, Jordan, I am an old, old man, it is true, but I'm not as old as Barry Mazur. Like, I think when you're a college kid,
yes.
like, the difference, you can't, literally, like, you don't know the difference between, like, a 45-year-old
right.
and a 60-year-old, right? Those are, like, this, like, people who are in completely different generations, they're all, like, the faculty
uh-huh.
to you. So I guess that's the long way around. Right now I see, obviously, Percy is a kind of singular character who has had this, but, I mean, I don't think I even knew that he had a life outside mathematics when I was
uh-huh.
a college student. He was, like, a professor who, like, taught courses and, like, knew a lot of math, and I, like, learned math from him, and that was what, I mean.
I guess what I'm getting around to is were there individuals, certainly as an undergraduate, then later in graduate career, that sort of, in a sense, might have served as models for you?
Yeah, Percy was one, Dick Gross was another.
Mm-hmm.
But in this very classical way, I mean, Dick Gross taught a course in representation theory, an undergraduate course, which is like the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, like the representation theory of finite groups. And that was one reason I think I feel very happy about the way, for me, it worked very well, like not going hardcore into, okay, I'm going to sort of start doing graduate work in algebraic number theory in my second year. Like, for me, there was a lot of value in being like, we're going to talk about something that was worked out in the late 19th century, which is like one of the most beautiful and amazing things humankind ever created, and we're not, and I'm not gonna like rush through the theorems and proofs in a week so that I can like jump to something more advanced. Like, I'm just gonna spend like a semester with Dick Gross, like marinating in this and kind of like wandering around this incredible edifice. And it was great. It was one of the absolute intellectual high points of me for me when I was in college.
Now, clearly, if you took your break for creative writing, that's a desire to communicate something,
right.
mathematics or whatever. Were you getting a chance to do that also in your graduate work in teaching? And was that an interest then, or was that just a sidelight at that time?
Yeah, I mean, so at Harvard, they have a senior preceptor there named Robin Gottlieb, and she's kind of the czar of training the graduate students how to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And that was incredibly interesting to me because I think at the time, I mean, what did I know? I mean, I thought teaching was I know math, therefore I'll sort of stand in front of a board and like open my mouth and that math will come out and it will go into the ears of the other people who are sitting there and then they'll know math. And like that was like as much about the process as I really understood. So Robin, you know, Harvard, to its credit, I think takes this pretty seriously. And you know, Robin videotapes you and you sit with her and you watch it and it's very uncomfortable because you see yourself and she like tells you everything that you did wrong and it's kind of like, you know, walking through a fire. But yeah, so I think, we were encouraged to take it seriously. We were encouraged to do a good job in the classroom, and to sort of think carefully about what doing a good job might mean. I mean, I love Stephen Krantz on this. Is this one of your guys' books or is this an AMS book? Like his book about how to teach mathematics? I forgot. I know one of the societies put it out, but...
Yes, and he's got books with both societies. There are a number of them, so.
I'm pretty sure I read this book of his when I was a grad student,
yeah.
And I thought what he said, and what I really took from it was him saying, like, and I sort of said this already, I guess, but I'll say it again, that there's not, like, a right way to teach. You have to, like, figure out what kind of teacher you are and be the best version of that teacher. You know what I mean? So he was like, if you're like a guy who makes jokes, like make your jokes good. But if you're not a guy who makes jokes, then don't try to be that guy just because you see other people succeeding in that way. You know what I mean? Like if you have like a lot of gravitas and you're very serious, like use that. You know what I mean? Be like the sort of Mount Rushmore stone pillar who people will like respect and want to please. And if you're more, you know, friendly and approachable, like be that. I mean, so I thought that was that was very useful advice for me at the time. I remember I actually had a teaching evaluation where I won't name a senior professor who I will not name, like sort of his comment was like he felt there was too much levity. I remember he used that word, too much levity. So he was more of a Mount Rushmore
yes.
type.
Yeah. Your PhD thesis.
Yes.
What area was that?
It was in arithmetic geometry, but essentially what I do now, and I work with Barry Mazur, algebraic geometry, algebraic number theory, arithmetic geometry.
Mm-hmm.
It was about Hilbert modular forms. It was definitely in the spirit of the Fermat type stuff that was going around. That was going around at the time, sort of trying to take some of those ideas and generalize them to higher dimensional abelian varieties.
All right, thesis is done. You're looking for a job. Or did you do a postdoc in between?
I did a postdoc. I mean, it was a job. They paid me.
Yes. True.
Yeah, I went to Princeton. I was already dating Tanya, who I'm now married to, and she lived in New York, so it was very, there was a big pull to sort of stay in the area. And, you know, Princeton has this system. It's great. I didn't really understand how great it was where you can be a postdoc there, but it can last like forever. Like you can be a postdoc there for like 7 years, which is what I did. I think actually theoretically you can do as much as 9. I think that's considered a little bit much, but, so that was wonderful because of course Princeton is the center of a lot of immensely interesting activity. And it meant that I somehow could build my whole research. I didn't have to kind of rush in 3 years to kind of make a case for myself as somebody who was hireable. It meant that I could really kind of stretch out and work on stuff in a long term and sort of be there in this very rich environment. You know, it takes 7 years to kind of really build up a research program that, and then sort of apply to places on the kind of like nearly tenured track, so to speak.
So when you were looking for a position, was it with the research specifically in mind, the kind of place you wanted to be at?
Yeah, but, you know, to me, like, what you got to remember is that, like, you know, nobody knows anything, like, right? People don't know anything about the stages beyond the stage where they're at. So we can talk about, like, okay, when I was in high school, how did I decide where to go to college? When I was in college, how did I decide where to go to grad school? When I was finished with grad school, how did I decide where to take a postdoc? But like looking back, I feel like I knew nothing and those decisions made sense to me at the time and I thought a lot about them, but in the end I don't think, like, I think like what was great for me about Princeton was not at all like what I had imagined. I had no clear idea. I certainly didn't think I would go there and I would learn a huge amount from, like, Peter Sarnak about, like, analytic methods and, like, stuff like that. I mean, I sort of, at Harvard, it was, like, barely mentioned that such a thing as analytic number theory, like, even existed. And it ended up that, like, you know, he's this hugely charismatic figure. He had, like, 13 graduate students, I think, when I got there. So it was, like, a huge amount of activity going around. You know, it was when this paper of Katz and Sarnak were coming out, so people were super interested in, like, random matrices and L functions. There was a huge amount of energy around that area. You know, I worked with Emmanuel Kowalski, who was Sarnak's postdoc. Like, we talked a ton. And then I ended up, you know, meeting Akshay Venkatesh, who was a graduate student there at the time, who's become, like, one of my central collaborators. We've written tons of papers together over many years. So all these things kind of came out of going to Princeton, but they were not what I thought I was going to Princeton to do. But, you know, that's why we have math departments, right? That's why we have these, like, big buildings that we put, like, lots of really good mathematicians in who are, like, doing different things, like, exactly to kind of strike these flints.
So how did you end up at Wisconsin?
In the usual way, I, like, did a big round of job applications, as one does, and I was lucky enough to, like, get a bunch of job offers, and then we, you know, like, a bunch of appealing places. And I just think we felt that Wisconsin, you know, it's a giant department with tons of stuff going on. It's not sleepy, you know, like, I mean, there's always something happening, like, more stuff than you can have time to do. And, of course, it's very, you know, I think at that point, Tanya and I were married. We were sort of newly married. We sort of were, you know, planning to have kids. And it's, like, it's a very pleasant place for, like, a young family to live. We could sort of see that the quality of life there was extremely high.
Mm-hmm. Now, as your career at Wisconsin developed, you have, looking at the list now, you have a lot of things going on. There's writing, teaching, research, and probably some other things that I don't know about yet. How do you balance and keep all of those going?
You know, one thing that's interesting, I remember asking Andrew Wiles this question when I was at Princeton. At some point, I was probably, maybe it was like my second or third year after PhD. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Andrew, I feel like I'm, like, constantly, like, running out of time, and at the end of each day, like, I'm like, oh my god, I didn't do, like, 10 things I wanted to do today. So, you do a ton of stuff, like, plus you have 3 children, like, how the hell does that work? Like, I cannot even comprehend how I could, like, write more papers than I'm writing now, and, you know, do more math than I'm doing now, and advise grad students that I'm not doing now, and have 3 kids. And he said it just kind of happens, like, somehow it happens. Like, somehow there's the things you have to do, and, like, you find that the things you have to do, you do. And I've certainly found that to be the case.
The dimension that's different for you compared to almost all other mathematicians is that you get out there to communicate, and you communicate much more directly than most mathematicians do. I mean, when you're writing for Wire and Slate and having your own blog and so on, most mathematicians can't even come close to that. So what's special there?
Well, I'll tell you something I learned about blogging. I started in some sense kind of late. I mean, some people think that blogging is dead. I think that's totally not true, but I think it works better in some contexts than others, and I think math is a place where it works great because you can't tweet math. I love Twitter, but you cannot tweet about math. All you can do is point to math on Twitter. Facebook too. I learned how to blog from David Carlton, who was my graduate school housemate, also a student of Mazur in Kleinman. He's now in Silicon Valley, but he's been blogging since forever. He's kind of an early adopter type. And he said something very important to me. He was like, the secret to blogging is you have to have low standards. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like writing something for the ages. And if you have those standards, you'll just never do it, and you'll write a blog that gets updated like every 2 months, and then you'll sort of forget about it and it will die. He said, you think of something, if you think maybe, then you should think yes. And just like type it up and type it up fast and put it up there. So I think that's like, I mean, for something like that, I do think that's how you have to do it, or else you're not gonna do it. And there's tons of like typos and mistakes and things that are ill-considered on the blog. And I think you just have to kind of be aggressively informal about it. And if people are like, you said something that was dumb, or you said something that was wrong, or you spelled something wrong, or you gave the wrong person credit, you just say like, well, it's a blog, it's not a monograph.
Right.
So I think that's the answer to like how that gets done. If you have low enough standards, you can do things very quickly.
But when you're writing for Slate or for Wired, I mean, if they are at all up to journalistic standards, they do expect you to be able to communicate well.
That's true, but you know, you'll notice that,
mathematicians ever do that.
I mean, you say, I do that a lot, but compared to an actual journalist, I do it very little, right? For Slate, I've probably written an average of, like, maybe one or two things a year since I started doing it. So it's really, I mean...
But the difference is that it actually works. Most mathematicians who have tried to do that never hit the right level, never get close to what an ordinary reader or generally even a math-interested reader would be able to handle. And you somehow do.
Well, okay, so I think...
And that's
so now we're not talking about the time issue, now we're talking about like how to do it, is that
yes.
right?
Well, yes.
Because I don't think it necessarily takes like more time to write well than to write poorly. I mean, it's...
True.
I mean, so one thing I do think it matters that I really did train for a year in this... I mean, I took a lot of creative writing courses in college, and I spent a year doing nothing but that. And I think in the end... prose is prose. Like, when you think about how to clearly tell a story and delineate a scene, and maybe most importantly of all, like, how to write a sentence. How to write a sentence that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
This thing I learned... Actually, I learned this before I went to grad school. I learned it from John Gardner, who is sort of the great writer on writing. You know, he has a book called The Art of Fiction, which, from the title, you'd think would be about fiction, and he was a novelist, so that's what... But most of what's in it has nothing to do with fiction. It has to do with, I mean, it was from him that I learned that when you write a sentence, you should read it out loud. And if it sounds bad, it's not a good sentence. That it actually matters. Like, that one of the things that matters when you choose a word is, like, what letters are in it. Like, what phonemes are in it. I mean, we, you know, we think of writing as, like, again, sort of like I was saying about teaching. If you think of writing as like, okay, there's some information here in my brain, and it needs to, all that needs to happen is that information needs to be present on the page, and then it'll go into somebody else's brain, like that's, you know, that's 1/10 of what writing is doing, right? I mean, like, sound matters, phrasing matters, connotation matters, all kinds of things beyond like the literal meaning of the words on the page. So I think, so one thing is just, as I say simply, that I was like, trained in that and spent a lot of time thinking about it in the context of prose fiction, but I think 80% of that information carries over. I mean, even the part that's about telling stories, right? Even the part that's about narrative, I think, carries over. I mean, maybe, like, stuff about, like, dialogue doesn't really carry over. I mean, there's some stuff that doesn't. And then I think, you know, when I was in grad school, that was when I started to learn something about journalism, which has its own rhythms. So sort of there's a crazy magazine called the Boston Book Review, which was running in Cambridge at the time, who would basically, I don't remember, did they pay? I don't think they paid, I don't remember or not, but in any event, they would take anybody's stuff. They would run out of a storefront in Harvard Square right above Wordsworth Books, which is now gone. And so I'd write a lot for them. I would write book reviews. It was basically a book review magazine, and I would write book reviews of books with some mathematical content and other stuff too. And so I learned how to do that kind of thing there, how to kind of like write like a 800, 1200 word piece about a book. And from there, I started writing for the Boston Phoenix and occasionally the Globe. Because, like, you know, it's, I mean, you know, once you've done it, like, once you have clips, like, once, I think it's hard to kind of walk in the door and be like, oh, I know stuff, so you should let me write. But once you sort of have some published stuff, like, it's, it lowers the barrier to doing more. So I think I learned that by doing. I did a thing for the Phoenix. My parents still lived here. And the MLA convention was in Washington, D.C. And I covered it for the Phoenix. I wrote a feature story. And it was super fun. I mean, I was, like, pretending to be a journalist, right? I bought, like, a little notepad, and I, you know, I went around talking to people, and I was, you know, thinking, like, God, these people know I'm, like, really just, like, a math grad student. I'm not actually a newspaper reporter, but somehow I had this assignment to do this thing. And, you know, I can look back at that stuff and see, like, a million things I did wrong, but, I mean, you know, like math itself, you know, practice is a huge amount of part. Is a huge part of it. So I guess what I'm saying is, by the time I started writing for Slate, which I think was in 2001, I'd actually done it kind of a lot, and I had some kind of sense of what things I could say and what things I couldn't say. Slate is a special place in that. I mean, I've written for them way more than I've written for other places. I've written for all kinds of places because I think they, not just in math, but everywhere, are interested in people who really know. Like, if they want something about history, they will, like, go find a historian.
Mm-hmm.
That's who they will ask.
Right.
So they asked me. I mean, this came from them. I didn't pitch it to them. They were like, we want to have a math column. Like, who do we know who does math and has, like, some amount of writing experience and some amount of journalistic clips? So they came to me and said, do you want to try this? Do you want to send us some sample columns and see?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think maybe I'll say one more thing about this, about which is that I think people often see the challenge of writing about math for the public as like, oh, how do I dumb this down so that I can express it to the public? And that, I think, is the wrong way to look at it. I do actually think that's wrong. I think if there's something that you'd like to explain, but you feel that you can, that in order to, you could only say it in a dumb way, if you were going to say it to somebody who didn't, who wasn't familiar with the technicalities of the subject, you're like, okay, this is my problem that I face, like, how am I going to do this? I think the right answer is, don't do that, do something else. Because there's so much in mathematics that you can give some sense of. Like, one thing I did, and this was pretty recent, that I thought was one of the most successful things about pure math that I wrote, was this thing about Yitong Zhang and the bounded gaps. And I think what made it work was that I quickly realized that there was no way to write about what Zhang actually did.
Mm-hmm.
Like how he proved what he proved. I mean, it would have been like just pointing at something that was like infinitely far away that you couldn't actually see. Like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So instead I wrote an essay about like, why did all mathematicians believe this fact was true? Like, before it was proved, what's the source of our intuition that it was true in the first place? And that's much easier to explain, and I think it really is mathematics. It's a part of the mathematical enterprise that is not proving theorems, but I think the general public, I'm not even sure that they know that we have intuitions, right? I mean, when you really talk to people outside math about math, you realize just how weird, from our point of view, the general view of the mathematician is. Even if they even know there are people who are, like, not dead people in robes who call themselves mathematicians. I mean, once you get past that point, I think they think of us as incredibly programmatic, logical, deductive, step-by-step thinkers. The idea that we guess about stuff, that we have intuitions, that our intuitions drive us, that's something that we can convey, and we can even convey something about what those intuitions are and how they're formed. And I think that's vital, and it's, you know, that you can really get across in a 1,200-word piece to a general audience, whereas, like, what an exponential sum is and why we think it might be bounded above, like, you know, you can't do it, so you don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can't.
Now, somewhere along the way, you also wrote a novel.
Yes. I wrote that when I was in grad school. I mean, I wrote it when I was... I revised it and finished it when I was a first year grad student. So I was like 22, 23.
But actually got it published too, which is...
But much later. So I had big plans. I had an agent. I sent the novel to all the big New York houses. I was super ready to be like a young literary star, and none of them bought the book. I mean, I got very friendly letters. They were like, we like it, you're a good writer, but they all felt it was not commercial. It was, you know, and it was a novel about, you know, people in a kind of small college town in the West who sort of study like a terrible poet who wrote in an obscure Eastern European language, and it was so I think at the time I was mad. Like, in retrospect, I was like, yeah, they're right. I mean, I'm proud of it. I think it's a good book. But they were not wrong that it was not commercial. And later, you know, just years later, I happened to hear from a friend that Coffeehouse Press, which is a kind of a medium-sized nonprofit press in Minneapolis, was, like, looking to, like, add to their fiction list. And I was like, why not? Like, this thing's, like, sitting in my filing cabinet. So I sent it off, and they wanted it, and it was tremendously exciting, and I love those guys. They did an amazing job, you know, editing it, like really the kind of classical, kind of close reading, like mm-hmm. word by word, with Chris Fishback, who's my editor, who's now the head of the press. And yeah, that was a really wonderful mm-hmm. experience. And, you know, the number of, it's definitely a small exclusive club of people who have read it. I mean, as I said, it is not commercial, but I was happy that I did it. I learned a lot from doing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new book, how did that come about?
Well, it was something that I had in mind for a long time. Even the title is very old. I like sort of searched my email for it, and it's at least, it's been at least 10 years I was telling people I was going to write a book with this title. But it was very unformed. So when I really decided to do it was, so I had a sabbatical, you know, as we have in academia. So I had tenure, right? I had a sabbatical coming up, and because my wife actually has like a normal person's job that doesn't like, that you actually have to be at, we were not going to like move away mm-hmm. from Wisconsin and like, you know, go to Paris or Rome or mm-hmm. California or whatever, like as people do. For a year. So I was like, well, if I'm going to sort of stay physically in the same location, it's somehow not in the spirit of sabbatical, right? To be like, okay, I'm just going to do what I was doing anyway, but do it like 40% faster, right? That's, mm-hmm. So I was like, if I'm going to physically be in the same place, I have to like psychically completely separate myself and really like not do what I would do anyway, but do other stuff. So I was like, well, this is the time to do it. If I'm going to do it, when else am I going to do it except when I have sabbatical? So I, you know, in the year before I sort of wrote a proposal. Actually, I'm looking back at my email from that time, I had crazy ideas. I was like, okay, my plan was like a year of sabbatical. My plan was half the year I was going to write this book, and then half the year I moved myself into an office at this place we have called the Discovery Building, which is this kind of big interdisciplinary research institute we have at Wisconsin. Where there's a lot of immensely interesting stuff going on in what's called, they call it optimization, but it's like this kind of beautiful interdisciplinary group between computer science and engineering mm-hmm. and statistics doing signal processing, data analysis, machine learning, like, mm-hmm. I mean, immensely interesting mathematics. But something I feel strong about is I think there are not enough people who identify as mathematicians who are doing that. So I wanted to go hang out with them and like learn about that and do that. So I sort of moved myself over to their building and like didn't set foot in the math department. And it was great. And I actually did do that, and it's been a lot of time. And I still like think about this stuff a lot and like hang out with those guys. It's like immensely interesting stuff. But what I discovered is that you certainly can't write a book in a half a year, at least not this kind of book. So that was completely unrealistic. So that, I mean, somehow, you know, I sold the book. And then they were like, okay, like, will we expect delivery in, like, a year and a half? I'm like, a year and a half? Like, what am I going to do with the other year? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out it does take a year and a half. That's what I learned. I had no concept. And you know what happened was I submitted this proposal, which is very funny to look back on now. It had, like, 18 chapters. But you know how math is, right? Math, it's all connected, right? Everything's connected to something else. You're thinking about one thing and learning about it, and then, like, you see an interesting thread, so you follow it, and you're like, oh my god, it's attached to some other immensely interesting thing, and I have to like walk over there and look at that, and then you sort of, so you do this process for a long time, and it's immensely fun, but what you find is that at some point I had to write Penguin and be like, well, I've written 3 of the 18 chapters I promised you, and I have about 300 pages. So, you know, do you more want an 1800 page book, which I'll give you in like 7 years, or do you more want me like just to do 5 of these and we'll like call it a book? And of course, they're business people. They were like,
yes.
Yeah, we don't want to try to sell an 1800 page book. We would rather have the book like on time and like do the parts of it you like best. So that was what, so that was what ended up happening. And, you know, like writing it was so fun and so enriching because partly just going into the history, which we don't learn, right? We have a completely ahistorical training. We have no kind of, I mean, there are people, right, who read the originals, but most of us are not like that. I certainly was not. So to kind of really make the effort to make some direct intellectual contact, like, with these people who built our subject, it's amazing, actually. It's amazing to try to put yourself in the framework of what it was like to be a mathematician at a time when these ideas did not exist, and to participate in their creation. I mean, it's quite amazing. I mean, one thing I found myself thinking about a lot is that when you really write about what people were doing in previous centuries, on the one hand, you feel this incredibly warm feeling of like, wow, there's really this tradition that has just been going on for like a long time, each person playing their small part, and where, I mean, we all say it, and to say it is one thing, but to really feel it is another. And the interesting question, which in my mind is still unsettled, is we look at these people, our forebears, and recognize ourselves as like carrying on their tradition. If they could see us, I do wonder whether it would be as clear to them that we're their descendants. I don't know. I don't have a good answer, and I don't know how to test it.
There are a lot more questions I'm sure I could ask, but just to sort of close things off, where do you see yourself, say, well, 5 or 10 years from now?
That's a good question. I mean, in my research, I feel like so far, I tend to like get excited about a new thing every few years. But that makes it hard to say like what it'll be. Like, I definitely don't do, you know, I did start, I talked about how I came into number theory at the beginning in this kind of gold rush around Wiles. And for the first few years of my career, like, that was really what I did. I worked on modularity of Galois representations. Which is still actually like an amazing and central field, and like incredible stuff is happening all the time. But I don't do so much of that anymore, and at the moment I do a lot of stuff at the interface between like number theory and topology, and I never thought, I mean, there's like, I've learned lots of like amazing topology that I never thought I would have occasion to learn, but I sort of had a great postdoc like fall into my lap. He came to Wisconsin, and then the guy who was supposed to work with, an algebraic topologist, left Wisconsin and moved to UBC. And it was exactly the moment when I sort of was starting to realize that I might need to learn some topology for a project I was doing. And so we started, this is like Craig Westerland, who's now like, you know, one of my central collaborators on this project with Venkatesh. And like, so again, these kind of accidental connections that come from physical proximity, it was my incredible good luck that an extremely talented young homotopy theorist like fell into my lap at exactly the moment that I needed somebody to talk to. You know, I would love it if like 5 to 10 years from now, I had really managed to bring some of these questions about machine learning and the geometry of data. I mean, I certainly aspire to have that be a part of my research program. Like, I would never want to do it instead of what I'm doing now, but like, sure, throw it on the pile. Like, I would love, I mean, so that's something that I've been learning a lot about and thinking a lot about, but I haven't like written papers about it yet. But I hope I will. I hope a lot of mathematicians will. Actually, because that stuff is going to happen, whether we, pure mathematicians, like whether we're in the room or not, it's going to happen. Because I love our way of thinking about things, I think it'll be done better if we're there.
And for other types of projects, writing, things like that?
You know, who knows? It'll develop. It'll develop how it develops. I mean, there's lots of stuff that I could write about that didn't make it into this book. Some things I think, honestly, because I didn't feel like I was reporter enough to do it. I mean, some stuff in this book is reported, but not that much, right? I don't know whether that's like something I'll pursue or not, to like to learn how to do stories where you really have to kind of push to get the information that that you want.
Okay. Good. All right. Unless you have some final words.
No.
We covered a wide range of things.
Yeah, this is good. It was good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.